Hi, everyone. Marcy here. Today, we're talking about unique career journeys, the power of networking, and crisis leadership. And we have a special guest interview today with Jetan Da Silva.
As always, in the spirit of respect, reciprocity, and truth, we acknowledge that this podcast is being recorded on the traditional territories and oral practices of the Treaty 7 region in southern Alberta and Region 3 Métis Nation. We acknowledge all nations, Indigenous and non, who live, work, and play on these lands, and to all who assist in their stewardship for generations to come.
So we're fortunate to have Jetan with us here today to talk about unique career journeys, the power of networking, and crisis leadership. Jetan previously served as Alberta's Deputy Minister of International and Intergovernmental Relations. She also worked in Canada's Foreign Service for over a decade, specializing in Canada-U.S. relations. She had held various posts in the U.S., including Consul General of Canada in Chicago and Head of the Environment and Fisheries Section at the Canadian Embassy in Washington. She's also worked as Director of Canada-U.S. Advocacy and Mission Liaison and Director of U.S. Transboundary Affairs at Foreign Affairs, Trade, and Development Canada in Ottawa. In January 2016, Jetan was appointed Alberta's representative to the U.S. in Washington, D.C., where she led Alberta's trade and diplomatic work in the United States and led Alberta's Washington office. Jetan is now back in Alberta, based in Calgary, and advising the Department of Energy. She's also fully bilingual, has a husband and two young girls. And I just also want to mention that I met Jetan when I was working at Alberta International Intergovernmental Relations, and she was the deputy minister. And that ministry is now called Economic Development and Trade. But she was the DM, and she really was an amazing executive champion for gender equity and diversity and inclusion type work. And when I was there, we had worked together to found a employee resource group for women in leadership within the department. And also she helped champion the one for the entire Alberta Public Service. So Jetan is a great advocate for these issues and was kind of the leader in charge of pushing this forward. So thank you so much for joining us today, Jetan.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, let's jump in. So please tell us how you got started in a career as a professional diplomat for Canada. We'd love to hear more about your journey.
So I come from a big family, and I was always the peacemaker in the group. So it was no surprise when I went off to university. I actually switched majors a bunch of times, but ended up majoring in international relations with a specialization in Middle East peace studies. And after I finished at school, I moved to Ottawa to be a parliamentary intern, which is a great program if anyone out there is looking for something to do after you graduate. You spend 6 months working for an opposition member and 6 months for a government member. Just a fabulous introduction to how our democracy works and how it intersects with the public service. And I was essentially waiting for them to lower the bar on the Foreign Service test. For a long time to get into the Foreign Service, you needed either a master's or a PhD, or you had to speak a difficult language like Korean or Russian, and I only had a BA, and I only spoke French, and so I did a variety of jobs sort of waiting around, and then eventually they did. They had to offer the test. They only issue it once a year, and they finally said that you just need a bachelor's degree to apply, so I did, and much to my surprise, I passed on the first go-round. It's quite a competitive test, and when I joined the Foreign Service, I assumed they would put me on the Middle East file. I had worked while I was waiting at the Canadian International Development Agency, overseeing projects in the West Bank and Gaza. I studied the Middle East. I spoke a little bit of Arabic, but I always joke that they looked at where I grew up, and so the first file they gave me was Canada-U.S. energy trade. And so I, having grown up in Alberta, I guess they figured I knew something about that. And then my career as a U.S. specialist was launched. I spent my entire career in the Foreign Service with the exception of 2 years working on Canada-U.S. files, focusing mostly on the energy environment side. So I first did energy, and then I was posted out to Washington right away, where I started out just working on climate change. And then I was fortunate enough in my federal public service career to take part in two sort of fast track to management leadership development program. So I was promoted while I was there to the head of the environment and fisheries section, which was quite the experience. I would have been 27 at the time, and the only woman working in that section. And sort of, I had, as a result of this promotion, had to move offices from a small office to a large office. And in so doing, a man had to move out of that office, who was much older than me, and he wasn't super keen on that. Then I came back to Ottawa, and I worked at the Privy Council office. I went back to Foreign Affairs and pursued a variety of roles there. I did another management development program, and actually that's when I went over to Status of Women Canada. I was the number two at Status of Women for about a year, which was a great opportunity. And then went off to Chicago as Canada's Consul General, which is a tremendous, a real privilege there. I lived in Chicago, but represented Canada in Illinois, Wisconsin, and Missouri. Loved the Midwest. It was a fabulous opportunity, and I was happily going about my life there when I got a phone call randomly one day asking if I would consider putting in to be Deputy Minister of International and Intergovernmental Relations in Alberta. I never thought in my foreign service career that one of my moves would take me home to Edmonton, but was pretty happy to do that. So I moved back to Alberta at a fairly interesting time in Alberta's political history. I like to say I served four premiers in 400 days. So I started under Premier Redford, but I served Premiers Redford, Hancock, Prentice, and Notley before being asked to take over the position in Washington. I was the first non-former politician in that role. All of my predecessors had come from a political background, but given the change in political party in Alberta, and I was Premier Notley's deputy minister, and I'd served in the U.S. before she asked me to take on that role, and I was down there for 3.5 years, also at a very interesting time in Canada-U.S. relations and in U.S. domestic politics, and then just moved back to Alberta this summer and very happily settled back into life here.
Awesome. So in all of that, so you kind of started out with background in the Middle East and then ended up moving to Canada-U.S. relations and energy and environment with a little bit in fisheries as well. So what were some challenges that you experienced in your career journey and how did you overcome them?
I think the biggest challenge for me was, I'm very much a generalist in terms of my education and international relations degree is interdisciplinary. So I was used to knowing a little bit about a lot of things and having to find out information and become the so-called expert on the file. What was the greater challenge is I advanced very quickly in my career. So I had my first sort of the lowest rung of senior management position when I was 27. The Foreign Service is a very hierarchical organization. You join at the bottom. It does not matter what you did before, but whenever you join the Foreign Service, you start at the bottom. And when I joined, my classification was actually FS00. you even had to work your way up to level one because you were a development officer.
Wow.
And so jumping over, I was still technically an FS00 when I got promoted to the first rank of senior management. And to do that at a young age and, dressing in a very feminine way was a real shock to a lot of people. I was often the only woman in the room, always the youngest person in the room, often got mistaken for the intern or the coffee girl or the assistant. And I remember very clearly one meeting I had at my first posting in Washington where a Canadian company came in to see me. They were having some challenges with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and outlined everything that they wanted. And they said, well, it's nice of you to take the time to meet with me, but next time could we at least meet with the first secretary? And I said, well, you'd be welcome to meet with the first secretary, but he works for me. just a complete lack of understanding. And so that was a challenge. And I think your natural instinct is to prove that you're qualified and competent, to prove that you're there because you deserve to be and not because, you're a token or somebody. But I got some great career advice early on from someone who remained a mentor to me throughout my career was that people will see your competence. You don't have to spend all your time trying to prove yourself. Just do your job and do your job well, and people will come to respect you. And so I think that helped me as well, because I think sometimes people who are new to management or leadership positions try so hard to prove that they're good at it that they don't actually take the time to do their job. And so I just focused on getting the job done. And, there were obviously hiccups along the way, but by and large, that advice has held me in very good stead and helped me to earn the respect of my peers and continue to advance in my career. I also have two kids. I think the public sector is typically more respectful of your family situation and has been on the leading edge of policies like parental leave. I mean, it was only a few years before I had my kids that we changed from maternity leave to parental leave and changed the number of weeks you're allowed. That certainly changed the workplace dynamic when fathers started taking leave as well. They could no longer look at you as a woman of so-called childbearing age and ask when you were going to go off and have a baby because dads were taking time too. But that wasn't without its challenges. I remember coming back from my second maternity leave. And I met with an individual in the organization where I was working because I was in, you know, looking for an assignment. And she, who was also a mother, told me that I had risen far enough, fast enough, and that I had dared to take 2 full years of maternity leave and there would be no further promotions for me. Wow. Yeah. And this wasn't, you know, all that long ago. My kids aren't that old. And so I left that organization and I went somewhere where, you know, the fact that I had kids did not in any way impact their view of my ability to do my job. So I think you just have to, you learn to be resilient and you learn to keep fighting. And then you go back, eventually went back to that organization and push for parental rights and a better understanding of family dynamics and things. But, you know, I think in the end, like I said before, you just focus on your ability to do the job. Know you're there because you deserve to be and not for any other reason, and focus on that. And as Taylor Swift says, haters gonna hate, and you just do what you need to do, right?
Yeah. Well, I think that's a pretty common trend, unfortunately, that often women find that the place where they've had their children is quite often where they end up having to leave that place. I've heard this story over and over again, that companies don't do a great job of doing those transitions, and the fact that you got to come back and influence is great. What other ways have you been able to help advance gender equity in your work? And is there anything that has worked really well and that you can share for others to learn from?
So I think having been the only woman in the room oftentimes was helping advance gender equality because you're bringing a different lens, a different set of experiences. You're asking different questions. You know, any even a little bit of diversity changes the dynamic. And so just having been the first in many occasions, I think, changed the conversations. You know, I think also I really tried hard in my career not only to mentor people but to sponsor people. So to look for people with diverse backgrounds and experiences, people who hadn't a voice we hadn't heard around the table before, and give them the opportunity to speak. So I was fortunate to having been in many leadership positions throughout my career that I tried to give back just as those who came before me and helped me did, and do the same for others. I continue to mentor a number of people. I also tried to bring men into the conversation around gender equality. I think oftentimes a lot of these conversations focus just on women talking to women. Well, it's important that women understand and feel empowered. You're really not going to change these issues unless men are at the table. So being prepared to have those conversations, calling people out, you know, and not in a harsh way, but sometimes, you know, you get, you know, you're at a boardroom table and you're speaking and someone interrupts you, or you say something and then a man says the same thing and they get credit for it. There have been times when I've gone back to whomever was in charge of that conversation, if it wasn't me, and pointed out that was happening, because I think it's just so common that sometimes people don't realize the impact of that. I also think it's important as a leader to understand how your team members learn. And if you have introverts on your team, creating space for them to contribute, you know, lots of times women unfortunately don't have the same confidence when it comes to public speaking and maybe more reluctant to speak up. So trying to create a space where they have the opportunity to do that. So those are all things that I've tried to do, and I think things that can work well for others. I would also say it's just really important to be yourself. You know, I think part of my success in my career has been the fact that I'm authentic. I like to think that I treat everybody the same, regardless of their rank or position within an organization. And I think that's really gone a long way, because people trust me as a leader because they feel that I'm being honest with them. And when they trust you, then they're more inclined to listen to your ideas and be willing to try newer, different things. And sometimes that's required to advance gender equality and diversity in the workplace.
So let's talk about the power of networking. So we know that old boys networks have really assisted in advancing men's careers. And a lot of those types of clubs, even the Petroleum Club in Alberta, in Edmonton, and in Calgary, used to exclude women completely. But we know that building and leveraging a network is very important and can really assist and kind of accelerate your career. So I'd love to hear your thoughts and advice on this for our listeners.
Well, my whole career is based on having a network. I mean, that's really what a career in the Foreign Service is. It's about who you know and how you can get information and how you can negotiate and make deals. So that's been key to my career. In terms of my personal professional network, you know, I do have like sort of a women-only network, but I have tried where possible to break into the old boys network. I don't golf, and maybe that's a career shortcoming. You know, so there's some things that I still don't do, but I can fake a conversation about ranching and rodeo and all kinds of things there. I think that you know, it depends. Actually, some of my greatest supports in my career have been men who would be at first glance, I think you'd think they would be a member of the stereotypical men's club. But again, I think if you're authentic in who you are and, you know, you take the time to build a real rapport, you know, I've gone to some of these people and asked them for advice, and it turns out, you know, oftentimes they have daughters and, you know, or they have sisters, or their, you know, their wife is actually very successful in her own career. And so maybe they don't portray it in a bigger setting, but in a one-on-one might be more willing to help out. It surprised me a few times, actually, that people within my network who have been my greatest champions, people I didn't expect, people who were quieter about it, maybe didn't speak up in a larger meeting. So that's been tremendously important to me in my career. Most of my career moves have not been things I have applied for, but things I have been asked to take on. But you really have to spend time in your network and invest in it, and make time and check in with people, not just when you need something, but regularly reach out and just, you know, see how things are going, offer support when they're going through a difficult time as well. I think that's really key to networking, is that often that people will be happy to reach out when there's good news to share. But if you're going through a difficult time in your personal life or your professional career, the silence can be deafening. And so making sure you're one of those people who reach out, even if you don't know what to say, just saying, I don't know what to say, but I'm thinking of you, that goes a long way. And I think that that then helps that people feel that your connection there is genuine. And then when you do come to them for career advice, or you're looking for a career change, or you're trying to fill a position in your organization and you're looking for their advice, that they're much more willing to help you out because you've invested that time. And then it's not just a, it's not a transaction. There's actually some level of depth behind that relationship.
Right. And as a senior official, as the deputy minister, as an Alberta ambassador to the U.S., the head of the Canadian consulate, you must have encountered critical moments of crisis in your work. We'd love to hear more about your experience with crisis leadership.
Yeah, I always think it's funny when people say career in public service is boring, because I have never, ever been bored in my public service career. I mean, whether it's some types of crisis in terms of, you know, a public health outbreak that you're dealing with, or, you know, as a consul general, or had responsibility for consular cases. So if a Canadian was arrested while in the U.S., you know, we're responsible for making sure that their rights were respected. Or whether you're dealing with political change, I've dealt with, you know, I've had people dealing with pretty serious personal crises at work, you know, alcoholism, divorce types of things. And I think that, you know, leadership is a privilege, but it's also hard. And it's hard on a good day. It's really hard when stuff goes sideways. And I think people continue to judge women by a different standard in those types of situations. You know, we're often stereotyped as being overly emotional. But yet if you don't show your emotion, then they use a different word to describe you. And so it can be really hard to figure out how to navigate that, because you are in charge and people are looking to you, and yet you are dealing with the stress of that situation. And depending on the situation, it can be very emotional and very difficult. And so what I have learned over time is that you just really have to be who you are, right? And people are going to comment. Like, there's always going to be people that don't agree with how you dealt with a difficult situation. But I think you just have to take a deep breath. And I think it's in those moments that you actually really figure out who you are. I mean, the times I have learned the most in my life and in my career is from failure and not from success. And while leadership in crisis is the opportunity for failure, it doesn't mean you have to fail, but you still, it really does strip you down to the basis of who you are. And then you figure out how you want to move forward. And for me, it's always been my moral compass that's got me through. I mean, I've dealt with some pretty challenging situations. And at the end of the day, whatever decision I make, I'm the one who has to live with it. So being able to look yourself in the eye in the mirror or being able to sleep at night. Those are the key things for me. And so, you know, and as a public servant, sort of my two imperatives are, is it immoral or illegal? Or is anyone going to die? And obviously if the answer is yes to those, then you take a very, energetic and active approach. But also learning to when the crisis is real and when the crisis is manufactured, I think is a really important thing, because often if you're dealing with the political sphere, something that happens in the media or question period can feel like it is a crisis, but it may just be more of a tempest in a teapot. And I don't mean to diminish, you know, public perception is very important to politics, and that political pillar is key to our democracy and how we govern ourselves. But, you know, as a public servant or as a leader in an organization that is nonpartisan and apolitical, you do have to figure out where that difference is and what you as a leader in that organization can do to assist in that situation. Or is that something you just leave for someone else to deal with? So, you know, figuring out who you are, figuring out what your role is, and then remaining as calm as humanly possible. Humor always helps too. You know, in any stressful situation, I find that if you can introduce a little bit of levity, so again, people know that you are a human being. And I've learned over time to let my emotions shine through. Like if I cry, that's okay. You know, it's just an emotional outlet. As you know, some people yell. I'm not a yeller, thankfully. You know, but that's, people need to get their stress out. And, you know, I do think they do judge when people do still judge women in those positions by different standards. So you just really have to be comfortable in your own skin and do what you feel is right.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I just want to build on that a little bit because we know that in crises, in moments of crises or stress or tight even timelines, people's biases are amplified and they more often revert to stereotypes or snap judgments on different types of people. And working in the public sector, I mean, it's a very hierarchical, as you mentioned, environment. Very kind of command, almost like they expect a command and control leadership style. Because the whole public service, I was told once, was designed after like the British Navy structure of hierarchy. So, I mean, that's not that encouraging. But so what are your thoughts on that and how gender really plays into crisis leadership and how that could be mitigated?
Well, I think first of all, as a leader, you have to recognize that there's a power imbalance, right? If you're working in an organization like the public service that functions on hierarchy, you have to understand the power that you wield. So you need to first get over your voice of God syndrome, right? Where you're just maybe musing that you want to fix something or that something's not right. And then all of a sudden 10 people go off and spend 2 days and you get two binders full of briefing materials when you're just musing or thinking out loud. So you have to really understand the power that you wield. And then you have to understand that sharing power does not diminish your power. You figure out what decisions you need to make and you delegate and empower your people where you can. You're ultimately accountable, but there's no way you can possibly do everything. So you have to be comfortable with that, I think, if you're going to be successful. I think in those high stress situations where, like you say, biases really do come out, tempers are short, you have to take time to acknowledge the humanity of people. So you need to take the time to commend people for their good work, even when you're just so focused on getting the job done. You still have to be a human being and you have to be kind to people. If someone does something wrong, you can't in those situations necessarily judge someone by the standard you would if time was not so short and if tensions were not so high. So you also have to be compassionate in how you offer criticism or ask for correction. I think that's really key. And I think that if people are behaving badly, you have to call them out on it. It doesn't matter. You still can't excuse certain behaviors just because the stress levels are high or because time is short or because the minister's on the phone and needs something right away. There's just no excuse for that. And so you can't let things go. Maybe in the moment, if your timeline is short, you can't have as complete a conversation about it as you would like to, but then you need to come back to it. You need to call that behavior out and stop it. And then when you have time, you need to go back and close that circle so people know that it wasn't just you in the heat of the moment losing your temper because then they can turn around and blame it on you. Mm-hmm. And I think you also have to be aware that as a woman, you're going to be judged differently. Or if you're a person of color or someone who speaks English isn't your first language, I think to be aware of that dynamic and to watch for all of those small things, you know, like, for example, there's things I've never encountered as a white woman, right? But you, if you are aware, you learn to pick up on things about the, you know, people of color. Where are you from? Know where are you from? Mm-hmm. Right? All of those types of things. And so if you can be woke and remain woke in those situations, right? And not turn off that human side of you in those situations and continue to demand the same level of morality and compassion you would request in a normal day. I think that that's really key to getting through that situation with your team intact and with your own, your own view of yourself intact. But you do have to be aware. And then again, as I said before, there's some people you're never going to win over, and they're always going to judge you by a different standard, and they're going to look for someone to blame, and they're going to blame you because you're the woman in the room, or you don't look like them, or whatever the case is, right? Especially if their idea isn't advanced, you know, they think they've got the perfect solution, their solution's actually crap. There's always those people that are going to look to you and be like, oh, it's your fault. She hates me. She's a woman. She's a man hater. And you can't, there's not a lot you can do about that, but continue to lead by example. And then if they're bad mouthing you, you've got to call them out. You really have to be prepared to have difficult conversations. You know, I often joke that if you're planning to pursue a career in leadership or management, you should get a degree in psychology or counseling first, because so much of your time in those positions is not really spent on the substance of things, right? Mm-hmm. It's spent on the mechanics of things and how people get along or don't get along. And so you just really have to remember that despite everything else that's going on in the job you need to get done, you're still expected to lead in an ethical way, and you have to get your team through that. And that means praising people for good work, and it means calling out people and having difficult conversations when things go sideways.
So we've spent the last few minutes talking about some of the challenges. Can you maybe give us some highlights from your career that you're proud of?
Oh my goodness, I've had so much fun. I mean, I just never expected to do some of the things I've done. I was born in a small community in the Northwest Territories. I'm the first one in my family to get a 4-year degree. And so sometimes I just look around and think, you know, how did I end up here? I think that's the wonder and beauty of Canada. I mean, when I was a consul general, we had this really beautiful home, and I was invited to all types of conversations that, you know, someone with my background normally never would be. Like, I remember Chicago hosted the NATO summit when I was there. And so we had the prime minister and the foreign minister and the defense minister and a whole slew of people. And I was the one who marched out on the tarmac to greet the prime minister when he deplaned. And I'll never forget, this lovely Marine was marching in front of me. It was a full color guard with flags and everything. And he turned to me and he said, "Ma'am, there's a grate out on the tarmac. Don't let your heel get stuck." And I was like, oh, bless you. Because the last thing you want, you're marching out to meet the prime minister and your shoe gets stuck and you have to keep walking. But I had a dinner with Madeleine Albright.
Oh my goodness. Just, that's amazing.
A real personal highlight. She's this tiny, I mean, so tiny, but an absolute powerhouse and an incredible intellect. And I'll never forget, that was an insane week. My kids were very little. I was coming from one thing to another thing, and there was a Target across the street from where the dinner was, and I was out of toothpaste and something else. And so I'm like, I'm just going to dip over to Target and get toothpaste. And it was probably tampons or something. And I grabbed it. And then I realized I had this tiny little purse, because of the other thing I found, that as a woman, you know, they don't make pockets in women's suits. So you have to carry a purse, but I was trying to carry a very small purse. So I show up at dinner with Madeleine Albright, and I have a plastic Target bag with toothpaste and tampons in it. And she just looked at me and she's like, "Yeah, you know, you're just multitasking like the rest of us. Just stick it over there in the corner." And I thought, oh my goodness, Madeleine Albright just told me to stick my Target bag under my chair. But, you know, I was at this dinner with defense ministers and Madeleine Albright, and just this really incredibly rich conversation. So that was a lot of fun. You know, I think that when I was in Alberta as deputy minister and, you know, led my organization through some challenging times, I'm very proud of the fact that, you know, that the organization came through that intact, and, you know, everything that we went through there, that, you know, we were able to continue to perform and deliver and serve the premier in the way that was expected of us in some very challenging circumstances. A lot of noise, like a lot of attention from the media, a lot of political attention. We're still able to get the job done. So I'm proud of that. And I'm just proud that I've been able to, you know, get to where I am in my career, but still have some degree of work-life balance. Everybody defines that in a different way. Mm-hmm. And some weeks are better than others. But, you know, on the days when it's hard for me, when I'm wishing I were with my kids or doing something different, then I just remind myself that, you know, for my kids, you know, the question that like I like to tell them, when I was in grade six, I was in academic challenge, and my teacher asked what I wanted to be, and I said I wanted to be a marine biologist, and he told me I couldn't be that because I was a girl. Uh-huh. And so I went home. I lived across the street from school, and I went home, and I didn't cry in class, but I cried when I got home. And my dad was a pilot, but he was home that week, and I told him, and he was livid, and he marched over to the school, and the teacher had to apologize and everything. But when I tell my girls that story, they just can't fathom that anyone would, like, why does you being a girl change your ability to do anything? Mm-hmm. And the fact that I've had the positions I've had is part of that for them, right? Modeling to them that mm-hmm. you can do whatever you like, you know, whether you choose to be a stay-at-home parent, whether you choose to run your own business, whether you want to be queen of the world or run for public office, like whatever you want to do, it's all mm-hmm. open to you. And your gender, the color of your skin, who you love and how you love them doesn't make any difference in any of that. So I'm very proud that they're growing up in a different world. We still have a long way to go, but you know, it's changed from when I was a kid, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
That's encouraging. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Jatan. Some key takeaways from this episode include don't just mentor people, make sure you also sponsor people and ensure that other diverse leaders and individuals at your company or organization have a chance to contribute and that their voices are also heard. It's important to bring men into gender equality conversations and to bring them to the table for these discussions and encourage them to be allies. And also, it's okay to sometimes have to call people out. So if you're being interrupted, if people are reiterating the same point that you'd previously said, you know, feel it's okay to point that out in the meeting or go to the organizer afterwards and enlighten them about that so that it doesn't happen again. And in terms of networking, network to develop deeper relationships with people and find opportunities to assist them to make it not just transactional in nature. And then lastly, be cognizant of your biases in times of crisis at work and just remember that the norms and expectations shouldn't change in crisis around people's behaviors at work. And it's important to still acknowledge humanity in people and to approach difficult conversations head on and deal with the inappropriate behavior when you're in a position of leadership.
Yes, and I'd also like to add that I'd like to thank you for reminding us to make sure to be our authentic self. I think that's important. And we can all do better at creating an environment where people can be their authentic selves, right? I know I was at a conference last week and this came up there as well, is that some of the best cultures are the ones where people don't have to play a role, right? Where they can be authentically who they are. And that's when we bring our best selves to work. So thank you for that reminder. So, all right. To our listeners, don't forget to check our resource section of this podcast because we'll have references for this episode. And once again, you can find our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and Buzzsprout. And please hit subscribe because you'll have notifications from when a new episode is released.
And let's continue the conversation. So please let us know what you think. Send us questions. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and we'd love to hear from you. So thank you so much. Thank you so much, Jatan. And until next time.